Okay, thank y'all. Please be seated. Okay, we have one final argument today. And the panel for today's argument, for the 3:30 argument, is myself, Jay Wade Birdwell. To my left is Justice Walker, and to my right, what's your name again? Justice Basil.
J. Dabney Basil.
So anyway, if you'll call the case, please.
The court will now call University of North Texas Health Science Center versus Marcy Paul. And may it please the court, Ms. Allison Collins to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Jason Smith to argue for the appellee.
May I please the court?
Sure.
Texas on behalf of the University of Northern Texas Health Science Center. Plaintiff Marcy Paul was a non-tenured track professor at the University School of Public Health. She worked pursuant to a series of one-year employment contracts with no guarantee of continued employment. Around 2018, the university decided to take its Master's of Public Health program in a new direction. First, it revamped the master's practicum. This was a one-year externship with a public health agency that was overseen by faculty members. Rather than the previous loosely structured individualized program, the university transitioned to a more structured, standardized curriculum and syllabus for all students and supervising faculty. Additionally, the school sought a research-centered, tenure-track professor focusing on maternal child health, commonly called MCH, because as plaintiff recognized at her deposition, UNT was looking to build a maternal child health concentration within its master program. Now, this case stems from Dr. Paul receiving a notice of contract non-renewal after she obstructed implementation of the new practicum's curriculum, and after she applied for but was not selected for the tenure track professor position because she was not qualified for it. Plaintiff asserts that she was terminated and denied the promotion due to age and sex discrimination. However, she failed to state claims that fall within the Labor Code's limited waiver of the university's sovereign immunity. First, as thoroughly set forth in our briefs, plaintiff has failed to set forth a prima facie case of age or sex discrimination related to her termination. To do so, she was required to show that a similarly situated comparator was treated differently. That's because after her contract was terminated, the university did not replace her. They took her course load and distributed it amongst existing faculty. Plaintiff does not make this showing. She instead attempts to argue that Dr. Greiner, the individual hired for the tenure track professor, the very position that plaintiff herself applied for and was denied before receiving notice of her contract non-renewal, somehow replaced her. As I just expressed, this simply was not the case. They were colleagues at the time that Dr. Paul's contract was not renewed. Additionally, plaintiff's own testimony shows that at the time that her contract was terminated, her cases were redistributed amongst faculty that did not include Dr. Greiner. It was other faculty, not her.
Let me ask you a question, Counselor. The fact that at the time she was a term employee, a year-to-year contract employee, and I think one of the positions that UNT has put forward has been that the legitimate justifiable reason for her termination was that she wasn't complying with this internship program and the implementation or changes of that. Didn't that happen quite some time before she was told that she wasn't going to be renewed?
No. So she had stopped complying with the practicum during the 2018 into 2019 school year. And again, she's on a one-year contract. Per policy, the school has to provide her with a full year's notice of non-renewal. So you know, they had been trying to work with her. They had been trying to convince her, hey, can we get on board with this curriculum? She declined. But to your point directly, it doesn't matter if they would have provided her this notice in September or in January 31st when they did. They could not terminate her contract until the end of that 2019-2020 contract because of the one-year notice requirement.
Okay. Let me ask this question then, and maybe worded another way. Did UNT Health Science Center renew her contract during a time that this implementation of the intern program was still taking place?
No, it did not. When she was refusing to comply with the practicum, they then provided notice that when her next contract would be up for renewal, it would not be renewed. So not only was Dr. Greiner didn't replace her, she's not a similarly situated comparator for some of the reasons discussed in our brief. The primary reason being that as a tenure track professor, the focus of Dr. Greiner's work, or one of her biggest focuses, is research. Whereas per Dr. Paul's own testimony, the focus of a non-tenure track professor is teaching. Moving on to the failure to promote claims. Once again, she does not state a prima facie case.
So does that mean every non-tenure track professor will always be ineligible for a research tenure track position?
No, that is not our position. It is our position that that's
what it sounded like
here. It's the case here for a couple of reasons. First, Professor Paul has a PhD in gender studies, not in public health. That means that she is not competitive for grant-funded research through the National Institute of Health and other organizations, which are quantitative research. You're doing statistical analysis. She has no training in this type of statistical analysis. She works with qualitative analysis and participatory-based
approaches. Why was she interviewed then?
Why was she what?
Why was she interviewed then?
She was not. Per plaintiff's own deposition testimony, she was not interviewed for this. In fact, she takes great issue with that fact, that she submitted her application, that she sent a courtesy email to Dr. Walters, who was chairing the search, but she never heard again about her application. She was never interviewed. And that goes to why she was not qualified. She wasn't qualified. She wasn't interviewed. She failed to meet three of the primary qualifications for this position. One, that she didn't have a PhD in public health or something equivalent. She had no recognition or promise of outstanding scholarship, being peer-reviewed publications. And she also did not have a record or promise of sponsored research, being quantitative statistical analysis research. By her own testimony, the type of research that she, the types of grants, excuse me, that she did have.
Was Professor Greiner tenured before she got this tenure track, or was she non-tenured?
She was non-tenured.
Well?
She actually was okay. A PhD student with expecting her degree in May, and her
She'd
offer.
Been doing any of the research or obtaining grants?
Yes.
That would have qualified her for this particular position?
Yes, she had.
Quantitative or qualitative or
quantitative.
Both?
Quantitative. She was from a research-intensive university. She had been the first author on over 20 peer-reviewed articles during her time as a PhD student. She had also worked on numerous quantitative research grants alongside her professors at the University of South Florida and had two of her own as a graduate student.
Are you aware if Ms. Paul, Dr. Paul, did any kind of research like this during her PhD studies much earlier?
She did not, and that is shown on her resume. She was a communications major and master with a PhD in gender studies. Her focus had been on public health communications as well as services, community-based services, to individuals related to maternal and child health. So it was in quantitative research. It was participatory-based research and providing services such as peer education at historically black colleges.
Now, let me interject here. I mean, she was applying for a job in the same department, same field of study that she had already been working, correct?
I would take issue with that in terms of she was within the School of Public Health, but she primarily taught general studies courses. That's also on her resume. She was teaching courses on communications within public health. In the spring of 2019, she was slated to teach and did teach her first course that I, at least from my reading, was specific to maternal child health, and that was an introductory course.
All right, and go back to the posting the job posting, the very first qualification that they listed was a PhD in what?
In public health or something closely related field.
And then public health, that's pretty general, you would agree, right?
Well, no, a PhD in public health is fairly specific. There are a lot of schools throughout the university, including now UNT, that offers a PhD specific to public health.
Or, what's the language, or?
Or as a closely related field, which again would be focusing on something science-based, something quantitative, statistical analysis.
Because you're saying so? Or because it's just...
I think that's shown otherwise within this posting for the job of what was the purpose. The purpose was to have a concentration in MCH. The purpose was to have a professor who could secure these research grants from NIH, which would bolster UNT as a school.
Is that in the posting or is that in the depositions?
It is in both, I believe. In the posting, it talks about how UNT was in conjunction with another school, starting medical school, that they were going to be doing this maternal child health-specific field. And that the position, one of the other qualifications within that posting, is specifically a record or promise of sponsored research.
Are you aware that SACS requirements, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, oftentimes these job postings coincide in some ways with what the criterion is through SACS. Do you understand that, or are you familiar with
that? I am not familiar with that, but I will do my best.
And oftentimes there are situations where even SACS, the accrediting authority, enables these institutions to use certain types of educational qualifications in lieu of maybe, let's say, the actual specific germane degree type that you would expect would be needed to teach those types of classes. So in other words, it's not necessarily atypical for that or language to be in these job postings. Do you understand that?
Yes, I understand that.
And that or component could be interpreted very liberally.
I do understand that. Again, the position of UNT was that she was not within a closely related field because she had a humanities degree from a non-research intensive university. And additionally, aside from the PhD issue, she did not meet these other two qualifications, being having a history or promise of peer-reviewed publications or grant-funded research.
Who was her employer before she got fired, or they didn't renew her contract?
UNTHSC.
Health Science Center.
The Health Science Center.
What particular department?
The Behavioral Services Department, which houses the School of Public Health and the Masters of Public Health program.
Right. And she had a PhD in what again?
Gender studies.
So at some point, that passed muster for at least the job that she did have.
Well, it passed muster because she was an instructor for the university related to a service project that she was working on. And when she got her PhD, as was common, and probably pursuant to the very regulations you previously cited or agreements, when she got a PhD, they make you a non-tenure track assistant professor in recognition of that PhD, even though it was not within a related field. Regardless of if she met the qualifications, which again, we submit she did not, there were legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for not promoting her that have not been rebutted in this case. Namely, that she was not interviewed or recommended for the position by the search committee, and additionally, they hired a more qualified candidate. While plaintiff points to perhaps, she argues she's more qualified based on her teaching experience. But again, this was a tenure track research-focused position, and she has not otherwise shown beyond her subjective belief that no reasonable person in the exercise of impartial judgment could have chosen Dr. Greiner over her for this position. It's a very high standard, and it's not met here. Before my time runs, I want to address the alternative theories the plaintiff puts forward. I don't make out a prima facie case, but I have submitted direct evidence of discrimination, or alternatively, should be permitted to proceed on a stereotyping claim. But a stereotyping claim is simply a type of direct evidence case. The United States Supreme Court in Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins held that a sex stereotyping case, that a plaintiff must show that the employer actually relied on her gender in making its decision. It elaborated that sex stereotype remarks can certainly be evidence that gender played a part in an employment decision if it does not consist merely of stray remarks. So in other words, you can set forth a sex discrimination claim based on stereotyping remarks if those remarks are direct evidence. Now, this court's familiar with the test for direct evidence related to remarks. As set forth in our briefing, the two remarks highlighted by plaintiff don't meet this test. The one is a comment from September 2018 on a performance evaluation that she was at times abrasive. This is not direct evidence of discrimination because it requires an inference in order to be related to plaintiff's protected class, an inference such as the very studies plaintiff cites in support of her position. Additionally, that remark was not made close in time to either of the decisions, and it was not related to the employment decision itself. For example, back to Price Waterhouse. There, the Supreme Court held that the sex discrimination claim could go forward via direct evidence that the partners were asked to submit comments related to the plaintiff's promotion to partner. The comments directly influenced the promotion decision.
Let me cut you off real quick because it looks like you're running low on time, at least for this part. Let's jump to the age-related claim and the comment that you say is a stray remark in that. And in looking at page 14 of your brief, you know, it has to be related to the class of persons. Obviously, with age, if you're over 40, that's you meet that. Proximate time to the determinations. Are you arguing that this comment about one of the reasons they went with Dr. Greiner was because she, you know, one word, and there was the youthful view or youthful fresh ideas, youthful ideas. Do you believe that that was not made in proximate time to the determination?
I think that plaintiff has not proven that it was, and that's because it was made at an unspecified date after the promotion decision had already been made, at an unspecified meeting where he said something along the lines of, we're bringing in someone with young, new ideas.
Don't you think that lends itself to a fact question?
I do not in this instance because, again, all four factors must be met for direct evidence, one. Two, I think that something that there's no case law cited by plaintiff that a comment made later in time after the decision has been made, and we don't know how long after, that, hey, we're bringing in this person with young, new ideas, can relate back to a decision, which in this case was made by a search committee to not interview plaintiff and to not recommend her for the hiring. And that's all my time. Otherwise, I'd address that I also do not believe that it is directly related to her class of age.
Great. Thank you, counsel. If you'll add a minute to counsel's time, please.
May it please the court. There's ample evidence establishing a fact issue with regard to Professor Paul's sex and age discrimination claims with regard to being terminated and with regard to being denied the position. I immediately want to address a couple of incorrect statements made by counsel for the government. First of all, they claim she wasn't interviewed. Dr. Tomes, who they identify as the decision maker, testified at at Clerk's Record 264. He testifies that she was interviewed for the position. That establishes, and he concedes that means that they normally provide interviews to folks that are qualified, although he tries to back up from that statement and say, well, it was courtesy interview. In addition, they say that Greiner that there's not evidence of that Greiner was a replacement. Well, again, Dr. Tomes testifies in his deposition at Clerk's Record 270 that Greiner took the two classes that she was teaching at the time. They try to say, well, we made a decision to go in a different direction and offer different classes, and this is why they got rid of her. They said in their interrogatories, we're going in a different direction, and the classes taught by Paul no longer fit the curriculum, and information contained in her reviews. And when I asked them, well, what was the reason that you terminated her? We terminated her because of the practicum. Well, there's no mention of the practicum in her reviews. It wasn't so much of a problem for her or anyone else who had a problem with it that it was contained in her review. That, in and of itself, shows the pretext. They say the reasons they let her go were because they were in a review. But then they say, well, when you ask her what it was, ask them what it was, they say, well, it was the practicum. Well, the practicum is not referenced in her reviews.
Okay. Counsel.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
We get that, and I understand your position in the briefs that there was multiple excuses, multiple rationales, and at different times those rationales were given from different people, and also there was the issue of, you know, really who had authority and did they ever establish authority and who really made this decision. But, you know, you mentioned something that to me is important, and that is as far as the termination piece, specifically on the age discrimination, that she was giving the same classes. Let me ask it this way. What is your position? Why do you believe that she was, in fact, I guess using their comparator language, Dr. Greiner was the person who took her job?
On the website, the UNT website, it indicates that Dr. Greiner was teaching the classes that Professor Paul was teaching when she worked.
The same exact ones.
The same exact ones. You compare Professor Paul's testimony, and we included a screenshot of the website. Those are the same exact classes.
Now, of course, they make the point that two different teachers ultimately took the classes that Professor Paul had been teaching. Do you dispute that?
Their website disputes it. Their website indicates that Stacy Greiner is teaching those courses.
And this is in the record?
This is in the record. That's at Clerk's Records 406. Okay. But it's definitely in the record. Furthermore, these are the same classes that they say they want to go in a different direction because the classes by Professor Paul no longer fit the curriculum. But they're still teaching them 2 years later. It's on their website. So that further shows the pretextual nature of their decision. It's Justice Scalia that says in St. Mary's Honor Hall that if the stated reason for the termination is false or unworthy of credence, then it is proper for a finder of fact to infer that the real reason is an illegal reason. Now, in St. Mary's Honor Hall, Justice Scalia said, you don't have to conclude that. A jury could conclude, well, you know what? We think they got rid of her because she went to Texas Women's and we're UNT. But a jury could also conclude, based on the ample evidence in the record, that the real reason was because they liked Stacy Greiner's because she was young with new ideas.
Question.
A statement made by the decision maker.
Question. It's a little bit of both. Given the two classes that we're talking about right now, did those have any aspect of the alleged failure to go along with the practicum? In other words, were those classes that were part of this practicum that was supposedly the basis for terminating her?
No, they never tied the practicum issue to the what classes were being taught issue. In fact, when I asked them, well, you say in your interrogatory, well, what was of why you fired her? Well, the information is contained in the review. Well, what's the reason? Well, it's because of the practicum. But the practicum's not contained in the review. It contradicts their own sworn reason that
they gave. I guess maybe my question is was there some aspect, when they cite to the practicum, was there some aspect of how she was teaching those two classes that was the obstruction that they're now alleging?
And
are they being taught differently now by Professor Greiner?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record regarding either of those issues.
Okay. Secondarily, when counsel's talking about they've got to give 1 year's notice of non-renewal, okay? And does the notice have to include the grounds for non-renewal, or do they just say we're not renewing?
They could say, hey, thanks for your service, bye. They don't have to have good cause. It is not a – in fact, there's nothing in their agreement that prohibits them from saying, well, we're going to let – you're not working out. You're obstructing the practicum. That's good. We are going to fire.
My question is a temporal one,
yes.
Which is, are they counting the entire year of obstruction? In other words, they're supposed to be giving a 1 year notice of non-renewal. So, based upon the temporal aspect of it, you would think the only obstruction that they would be able to discuss, if in fact obstruction of the practicum was the basis for it, would have been any obstruction that occurred before the 1 year notice of non-renewal. Or are they trying to backdoor it by saying, well, it was the 1 year after we gave notice of non-renewal, all that other additional obstruction that justifies having terminated her?
I think that the state of the record is that the issue with the practicum was in the fall of 2017, in September of 2017. In October of 2017, they do a performance review. The performance review makes no mention of the practicum.
No mention of it whatsoever.
No mention whatsoever. And then in February is when they notify her that she's let go. And then, actually, in the fall, the following fall, after they let her go, they give her another great review. And then they...
Does the great last review say anything about the practicum?
It does not. There is not one word about the practicum or her obstruction of the practicum in either.
Thus your reference to Justice Scalia.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And the two specific classes that you were mentioning that you believe she was teaching and Dr. Griner ultimately teached thereafter,
Taught.
Did she teach those classes? Did Professor Paul teach those classes before the practicum was even on the table?
Yes. Those two classes were the heart of Professor Paul's wheelhouse in terms of teaching about issues of maternal and infant mortality. I'll cite you to the record. It's MRH maternal and child health courses taught by Professor Paul, and that website is 406. It's clerk's record 406.
Is it your position that we could find that Professor Paul was discriminated against through a wrongful termination and a failure to hire?
I believe that a jury could be, those two questions could be presented to a jury separately. I actually think it's all part of the same story.
Sure.
That she was denied, that she was terminated, and then she was replaced because of the 1 year.
And it would probably be a disjunctive jury question, because either Dr. Griner replaced her or Dr. Griner got the new job that she applied for.
Correct.
It couldn't be both.
It could not. I believe that's correct. Okay. I believe that's correct.
I'm not getting you to commit to it.
I'd have to think it through, but I believe that's correct. I believe the jury could answer, you know, one or two yes, and then they would answer three. Then they'd answer the retaliation question, which they didn't challenge on plea to the jurisdiction. And then they, number four, they'd answer the damage question.
And the reason I ask that is because, and how do I say this without telling you exactly what I'm thinking, but in some ways I feel like I need to kind of help you narrow in. You know, when it comes to the sex, I'm not too concerned to hear any argument on that today. But when it comes to age discrimination, you have the termination piece, and then you have this failure to hire piece. And really, it appears that the termination piece would really hinge on this idea of whether or not Professor Paul was replaced with one individual, or her duties were divvied up and given to several other people. And on the other side of that coin, you have the prima facie case that you have to prove up. You had to prove up on the failure to hire, and that is a little different. You don't have to worry about that multiplicity issue if that's what you want to characterize.
That's correct. The prima facie cases are different. For instance, on the failure to hire situation, the all you have to show is the position that they continue, the position remains open, they continue interviewing.
And it doesn't tell, the law doesn't say for how long, it just has to be after the fact.
Correct. And I think that while I think a jury could answer yes and no, or no and yes, depending on how the evidence came out and how they perceived it, I do think that the evidence of the decision maker said that Ms. Greiner was young with new ideas solidifies the and adds another element to the evidence for the failure to hire for the professor position.
That's where I was about to. That's where I was thinking when and asking those questions.
Yeah.
When you were talking about Professor Paul's wheelhouse, were those two courses essentially the same subject matter that she was unqualified to conduct research on?
Well, that certainly is their position, because she didn't go to...
No, I'm just talking about topic-wise. Yes. In other words, they're looking for somebody to conduct research on the very
yes.
topics that she's teaching and
right.
that she's at least qualified to teach at the university on.
Right. That's okay. correct. And for which she actually has obtained grants, and for which she is acknowledged as an expert, even by the dean who interviewed her. That he said that was her passion and her strength was maternal health, maternal and infant mortality.
Is there any concessions in the transcripts and depositions about this quantitative versus qualitative, and how sometimes professors will go from quantitative research to doing qualitative research and vice versa? Do you recall anything in the record pertaining to that?
Well, I believe that either Dr. Walters or Dr. Tomes tried to make that an issue. It's our position that was, one, that's not what they said in their interrogatory answer. So under G versus Principi, they're giving conflicting reasons, which makes them unworthy of credence, at least for an issue of fact, that they've done that. But more so, we believe that we don't see any evidence that was the reason that they wanted her out of the position. They say they want a different direction in the classes being taught by Paul no longer fit the curriculum. That's why they said they let her go.
In the interrogatories.
In the interrogatories. And that they're bound by those. And then information contained in the review, which doesn't include anything about any obstruction of a practicum. And we take issue that she was obstructing the practicum. She had concerns about the practicum, just like other professors did, but she didn't do it in an unprofessional way. She just raised her concerns. So with regard to the comments, even if the comments, I would argue that the comment of that Stacey Greiner was young with new ideas, it is evidence of direct evidence of discrimination that goes to the claim for the failure to hire. But even if it doesn't, Gadoo versus National Orwell Varco says that the Fifth Circuit held, and it's held repeatedly, that age-related comments or race-related comments or sex-related comments not made in the context of the decision or the interview can still be probative evidence to support a pretext claim. And so that it's not that they go away. It's just that they're analyzed instead of being analyzed as direct evidence, which does away with the need for the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting analysis. Instead, it goes to the issue of pretext and the whole batch of evidence. It just strengthens the issue of pretext.
Are we limited in our consideration with regard, since there are effectively two claims in terms of age, the basis for the discrimination alleged? Are we, can we consider evidence with regard to age discrimination also as influencing the sex discrimination and vice versa? Or has there, or, and alternatively, has there ever been a situation where you can kind of have a melding of those two types of concepts where they become actionable together, as opposed to, or are we in a cookie cutter? It either has to be sex discrimination or it has to be age discrimination.
There is case law that says that if you show evidence of a discriminatory animus towards one protected trait, it actually can be considered evidence with regard to another trait. And there are cases, mainly federal court cases, that say that. Now, I've told lawyers, I don't know that I could argue that in Tarrant County and make a lot of headway. But I do think the issue of age and sex, and that's what the statute protects. It doesn't actually protect gender discrimination. It outlaws sex discrimination. The issue of whether or not Ms. Greiner is a young woman with certain attributes, and Professor Paul is an older woman, I believe a jury could consider those that evidence together. They'll actually get two separate questions on the issue of age and sex.
It's the difference between the elements for liability and just evidentiary considerations. So it sounds like, from an evidentiary standpoint, those two things can be considered with regard to a demonstrating liability elements. All of that evidence can be considered with regard to effectively intent, if you will.
Correct. Okay. Especially the evidence of age.
But there's no basis for saying that, well, there's kind of like a hybrid age and sex at the same time type of thing.
Correct. There won't be a jury question on that.
Okay.
Mr. Smith, page 15, your brief, the four prongs for the termination claim, specifically thinking about age discrimination, or at least that number four, replaced by someone significantly younger. Obviously, the government has made an issue of this. Verbalize your position on how the whole shifting goes. You put forward that you have some evidence that it was just Dr. Greiner who replaced her. Then they claim, no, it was actually two people who took her workload. And then your response is, well, the website says that it's only her that's teaching these classes. Is that, or is there more to it than that?
No, that's it. I mean, it just undermines their position that she didn't replace her. But you can also go back to their own interrogatories, which say, well, we're going to go in a different direction because her classes no longer fit our curriculum, and then they're still offering the classes a year later on their website, being taught by Stacey Greiner.
It goes to the pretext.
Yes. But it's also evidence that that a finder of fact, and looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-movement, Professor Paul, that it is some evidence that she was replaced by someone significantly younger.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for allowing us to present oral argument.
I think Your Honors are perfectly capable of sorting out the factual differences by looking at the record. I will state that by plaintiff's own testimony, Dr. Greiner did not assume any of her classes at the time that her contract was terminated. That's at CR 237 through 238 and again at 246. I want to focus on this idea of why she was terminated, shifting rationales. The university has not had shifting rationales in this case, and there's two portions to that. So the interrogatory says the department is going in a different direction, and that's true. It was going in a different direction with the practicum. It wanted a standardized practicum, which plaintiff was refusing to get on board with. Because of that, her classes no longer fit within the curriculum. Why? Because when they looked at what courses she was qualified to teach, she had to be involved with the practicum to carry a full load of courses. So if she, her class style of teaching the practicum no longer fits with this new direction, there's not a place for her here. Additionally, along those same...
So the courses were consistent with the subject matter of the courses were consistent with the practicum.
But
the other courses that she would need to pick up...
They weren't there.
They weren't there.
Okay. She needed to be involved with the practicum. That is
given
what the dean decided.
Given how important, though, the practicum was, one wonders why it didn't show up on her evaluation.
And there's a reason for that. And that's because the practicum was directly supervised by the assistant dean, Dean Spence. She took her issues related to Dr. Paul directly to the dean, rather than going down to the chair, which was Dr. Walters. It is the chair that fills out her performance evaluations. So it is the assistant Dean Spence and Dean Toombs who are directly dealing with this issue related to the practicum. Is there a way we can get her on board? Are there alternatives, since she won't get on board with this program, of what she can teach? And Dr. Toombs reaches the conclusion that no, there are no other alternatives for which she can carry a full course load. But that's why we don't see it in the performance evaluation, because it was done at a higher level than Dr. Walters, the chair overseeing her department. I would note that the practicum does make it into her evaluation, which is primarily a self-evaluation. And she testifies, Dean Toombs testifies to that, that she admits that she was having difficulties related to this course. But that is the essential reason why it is not in her evaluations, is it was handled at a higher level than the chair level. It's worth noting that, again, they point out performance evaluations. And even despite Dr. Walters not being fully in the loop related to the practicum issues, he still rated Dr. Paul as not meeting expectations in professionalism in her last evaluation before her contract, before her notice of non-renewal. And that was in 2018. That's the time frame at issue here. I know counsel thought that it was 2017. I submit that it was in 2018 that this was occurring. And so he found that because she was not turning in her syllabi on time for her courses, and she was not being receptive to feedback. And that professionalism commentary also had nothing to do with his other comment that she was at times abrasive. That was in a separate competency area within her annual review under interpersonal skills and communications. So therefore, the reasons have remained consistent. What we have here is that Dean Toombs makes the decision. We have to give her a notice of non-renewal. She's not getting on board with our program for this practicum. After he's come to that conclusion, he consults with Dr. Walters, her chair, and says, I think we need to give her a notice of non-renewal. What do you think? He says, yes, I've also been having issues with her professionalism separately. That's why these reasons are consistent, and that's why there's been no shifting rationale in this case, supporting why she was terminated and why it had nothing to do with her age.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We appreciate y'all's arguments. They've been very helpful. The matter is submitted for our consideration, and we bid you good afternoon. Thank y'all.